Today is Tuesday, February 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the number of deaths from the coronavirus has surpassed 1,000.
More people died on Monday than any other day since the virus emerged in December. Chinese authorities confirmed the more than 100 deaths Tuesday morning.
We'll have the latest. Plus, the Philippines has notified the United States it wishes to terminate its visiting forces agreement. And rain comes to Australia, but will it help extinguish the bushfires? Those stories and more are all coming up next. The chief negotiator for the Darfur Justice and Equality Movement, one of the warring groups in Sudan's long civil war, says the Khartoum government has agreed to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court. Ahmed Tougoud-Lassane told VOA's English to Africa service that all four former Sudanese officials under ICC indictment will be handed over for trial, including Bashir. However, Sudanese government officials have not specifically named Bashir as one of those who will be handed over. The International Criminal Court indicted Sudan's former president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, on 5 counts of crimes against humanity, including murder, forcible transfer, torture, and rape. Though the ICC issued a warrant for al-Bashir's arrest in 2009, he was never apprehended, despite traveling abroad several times. He was deposed in a military coup in April of last year after months of nationwide protests against his rule and jailed in the country's notorious Kubra prison, where many of those arrested by his government had been locked up and tortured. Last year, a Sudanese court convicted him of corruption and sentenced him to 2 years in prison for elderly convicts. The death toll from the coronavirus outbreak in mainland China has soared past 1,000 Tuesday, with a record daily rise in fatalities. However, the number of reported cases has fallen almost 20% compared with the previous day. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy reports.
More people died on Monday than any other day since the virus emerged in December. Chinese authorities confirmed the more than 100 deaths Tuesday morning. One expert in China said there was hope of a turning point in the outbreak, but not everyone agrees. The World Health Organization chief voiced concern on Monday.
In recent days, we have seen some concerning instances of onward transmission from people with no travel history to China. The detection of this small number of cases could be the spark that becomes a bigger fire.
Infections outside China are still on the up. On Tuesday, a 3-month-old became Vietnam's 15th case. And in the U.S., a 13th case was reported on Monday in California. The CDC said the adult patient was among the roughly 800 U.S. nationals evacuated from Wuhan who have been under federal quarantine. Back in China, the government is coming under increasing pressure for its handling of the outbreak. President Xi Jinping toured a neighborhood in Beijing on Monday. "Let's not shake hands," the president quipped, before adding, "We must have confidence. We will overcome this epidemic." Dozens of health officials across China have lost their jobs for failing to contain the virus's spread. Hubei Province, the epicenter of the outbreak, announced 2 of its most high-profile dismissals yet. The Communist Party boss of Hubei's Health Commission and its director were sacked for unspecified reasons. They were dismissed while public anger has simmered over local authorities' response to the virus.
That was Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy. The 2,600 passengers on board the Diamond Princess cruise ship have been stuck aboard it since it arrived in Yokohama, Japan, February 3rd. Tokyo has reported more cases on the vessel. And for an update, I spoke to reporter Jason Gatewood.
Right now, we still have 2,600 passengers aboard the Diamond Princess. They're being quarantined by medical authorities here. And as of Tuesday evening, Japan time, an additional 65 people aboard have tested positive for the pneumonia-causing virus, bringing the total aboard to 135. However, the biggest development now is that Japanese officials are now planning to allow the elderly, along with those having chronic illnesses, other than any signs of the virus, they're allowing them to possibly leave the ship soon. Other passengers, however, will still have to wait out the government's mandated quarantine time until February 19th. As to be expected, morale is kind of low, and many are turning to social media to kind of pass their time as a way to take their minds off their situations and sometimes simply to complain and plead for help. Elsewhere around Japan, the number of people contracting the novel coronavirus has ticked up to 26. Residents who were evacuated from the virus's epicenter in Wuhan, China, are back aboard a flight that arrived January 29th, which was the first, I believe, out of a total four flights that the Japanese government evacuated, are now being given the all clear if their last set of quarantine tests check out. And we're expecting to hear back from those tests in the next 24 hours.
If we look toward the future, this summer we have the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo. Have organizers addressed the coronavirus concerns from many in Japan?
Yeah, that's always a major concern. Of course, those games are set to begin at the end of July. And most of the world's health epidemic organizations are confident with the number of cases in this outbreak, however, should peak fairly soon, including Japanese medical authorities. A meeting that was held at last Friday, game organizers, and there they let it be known that they're very concerned that the current spread of the virus could, quote, pour cold water on the momentum of the game. So that means that Japanese officials are wasting no time in getting out in front of the matter and approving emergency measures, keeping screening facilities, and providing as much aid as possible to the tourism industry are in effect now in order to soften the blow in the number of tourists coming to Japan. The government will also use some of these reserve funds from last year's budget to help speed up development of a vaccine and help provide monies to agencies in order to set up communication centers to prevent misinformation spreading about the virus while trying to increase the amount of up-to-date knowledge and communications about the epidemic. So basically, they're doing as much as possible to make sure that the games are expected to be pandemic-free and do as much as possible to alert the public and let everyone know that we're expected to be in the clear.
That was reporter Jason Gatewood, based outside of Tokyo, Japan. Economist Nicholas Lardy is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked him about damage to both the Chinese and overall world economy being affected by the virus outbreak.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt the first quarter GDP in China is going to be very slow, maybe something in the 4%, 4.5% range, down dramatically from the 6% of the fourth quarter of last year. But I think there will be a substantial recovery as we move through the year. Of course, that's conditional on bringing the virus under control over the next few weeks. If the virus is not brought under control in the next few weeks, the number of businesses that will reopen will be limited, and the negative effect on GDP will last significantly beyond the first quarter.
What are the main effects of the outbreak of coronavirus? Is it just China's international business, or is it domestic business as well?
I think it's both. There's certainly many domestic businesses closed. Some are still closed. So production is being lost, not all of which can be made up when things get back to normal. And Chinese tourism is obviously down dramatically, which has a very large effect on Thailand, Hong Kong, and countries in Southeast Asia, where Chinese tourists are a very, very important part of the domestic industry, the domestic tourist industry. So it's both domestic and international. It's also international because China's demand for imports is down significantly. We've had a reduction in transportation, and with factories closed, their demand for intermediate goods and inputs that they need is down significantly. Remember, China does import a lot of oil, but it also imports lots and lots of what economists call intermediate goods, that is, goods that are used in the production of other goods. And many of these goods come from East Asia or Southeast Asia, particularly Korea, Japan, Taiwan. So the exports of those countries to China are down significantly, and that will have an adverse effect on their growth.
Is there anything the Chinese government can do?
Well, they're doing quite a bit. I mean, they got a very slow start, and some would say a misguided start. But now they certainly are mobilizing resources to try to slow the spread of the virus. And the number of new cases has now been declining for several days, which could be a good omen if it continues. It would suggest that the virus will be brought under control over the next few weeks.
I don't know whether this has expanded or not over the past few hours or so, but I did see that Fiat Chrysler was talking about the possibility of shutting down its plants in Europe and elsewhere because they couldn't get Chinese parts, and that's the way the supply chain was set up. How far does this extend?
Well, it's very important. China, in the auto sector, China is the biggest producer of auto parts, and their parts go to Europe, obviously South Korea, and the United States. So if those factories remain closed for much longer, that will begin to impinge on the ability of some of these companies to continue in operation. Remember, the style these days is to carry very little inventory, rely on just-in-time delivery. But when the production gets shut down in China, then the effects are transmitted to the producers of automobiles fairly quickly.
What is the worst-case scenario worldwide if there is not an end to the virus scare?
Well, I think the worst-case scenario worldwide is that, you know, most estimates are now that global growth will probably not decline by much more than a tenth or two-tenths of a percentage point. If the virus continues to spread in China and China remains largely shut down, then I think the effect on the global economy could be several times larger.
Leading to what?
Well, I would certainly have the potential to push some countries into recession. I mean, some of the countries in Europe are already going relatively slowly, barely having their noses above water. And if you get a shutdown of the auto industry, for example, or closure of a lot of plants, in, particularly in Germany, it will probably push Germany into a recession.
That was Nicholas Lardy with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, speaking to VOA Asia's Ira Melman. The Philippines is notifying the United States that it will end a major security pact allowing American forces to train in the country. Philippines presidential spokesman Salvador Pinelo said the termination of the visiting forces agreement will take effect in 6 months.
The notice of termination has been sent, and the effectivity of that would be 180 days from the receipt of the U.S. government of such notice.
It is the most serious threat to the country's treaty alliance under President Rodrigo Duterte. The Philippine president has often criticized U.S. security policies despite the Philippine military's close historic ties with its former colonial power. The U.S. military presence in the South China Sea has been seen as a counterweight to China, which claims virtually the entire area. Earlier today, I spoke with Greg Poling at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I began our conversation by asking him what impact the notice has.
So for the Philippines, I think it means three things. One, you have continued presence of U.S. special operators in the southern Philippines, helping them fight ISIS-linked militants. That goes away in 6 months, right? All U.S. forces will have to pull out. Two, the next time there's a major natural disaster, which unfortunately happens with some frequency in the Philippines, it'll seriously slow down the ability of the U.S. to respond. And the U.S. has, in recent years, been critical in responding to typhoons and the like. And then three, it really gives China a green light to get even more aggressive pushing the Filipinos in the South China Sea, where they have a dispute, because they don't have to worry about the Americans being close by.
Now, this is only one of a number of treaties that the Philippines has with the United States. They also have a mutual defense agreement that is apparently going to remain in place, correct?
It will, but it becomes very much a toothless agreement, because the mutual defense treaty says that the Americans have a responsibility to protect the Philippines, and the Philippines has a responsibility to help the Americans do that. So if the Philippines isn't going to allow the United States to even enter its territory, how can the Americans defend them, right? If you were to look at the South China Sea, the closest U.S. forces will be in Okinawa. That's 1,300 nautical miles away.
So speaking of that, after the VFA goes away and U.S. troops have to withdraw, do you foresee them being relocated to someplace like Okinawa or other bases within the Asia-Pacific region?
Well, there's no really permanent U.S. base in the Philippines. Like I said, there's a small number of special operators, maybe in the neighborhood of 200, so of course they'll have to move. But what this really allows is rotational presence, right? You have about 300 exercises and security engagements every year. A lot of those, maybe most of those, go away. You have the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, which was signed under the Obama administration, that lets the U.S. invest in Philippine armed forces bases, and then the Americans get to rotate through them. So all of that goes away. It's not, the Obama administration used to use this phrase, places, not bases. It's about access, not that we have some huge footprint there all the time.
Is there anything that we're missing by just reading the headlines as to what this may mean, either for the Philippines, the United States, or security in the region?
So for the U.S., a lot of attention is focused on what this means for the Philippines, and that makes a lot of sense because it is going to be Filipinos who suffer in the short term, whether it's because of greater room for terrorists to operate or because of humanitarian assistance losing out. But for the U.S. side, this is about credibility. You know, the Philippines is the oldest U.S. treaty ally in the Asia-Pacific, older than Japan or Korea or Australia. To lose them sends a certain signal, right, that the U.S. maybe is declining. Maybe this is China's region to do with as it wants. It also seriously undermines the ability of the Americans to defend freedom of the seas in the South China Sea, which two consecutive administrations now have said is their primary concern in Southeast Asia.
That was Greg Poling with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And still to come,
authorities in Australia say heavy rain could extinguish all of the fires in New South Wales state by the end of the week. Parts of eastern Australia have seen their heaviest downpours in more than 30 years.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A 2012 Harvard Medical School-led study linked grief over losing a close loved one, such as a spouse, child, or parent, with a higher risk of a heart attack, which some refer to as a broken heart. The study proposed that this risk increased to 21 times higher than normal within the first day of a loss, almost 6 times higher within the first week, but dropped steadily over the first month to about 6 months. A new Australian study suggests the combination of a beta-blocker blood pressure medication and an aspirin could reduce the risk of a bereavement-induced myocardial infarction. Lead author Jeffrey Toffler, a professor at the University of Sydney, says his team found that the medication used in a low dose once a day successfully reduced spikes in blood pressure and heart rate, as well as provided positive changes in blood clotting tendency, all contributing factors to a heart attack. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Voters in the northeastern U.S. state of New Hampshire are casting ballots Tuesday in the Democratic primary as candidates look to build early momentum in the race to oppose U.S. President Donald Trump in the November national election. VOA's Carolyn Persutti is there covering today's vote.
Well, Steve, I'm actually standing inside a polling place not too far from the state capitol in Concord, New Hampshire, where they've seen a steady stream of voters since they opened at 7 this morning. Of course, as you know, the first votes, though, in New Hampshire have already been cast and announced. That's a tradition here in this northeastern state. In Dixon Knox, New Hampshire, north of here, 5 people voted, and they announced that someone who's not even on the ballot won that precinct, and that is Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City. And then in 2 smaller precincts, Amy Klobuchar won that race there. But of course, those are very tiny. It doesn't really set the scene for the rest of the state because we will still have thousands more voting throughout the day today.
So the voting took place early this morning, extends throughout today. When do the polls close in New Hampshire?
They close at 7 p.m., and then what happens is each of the individual polling places press a button, their electronic counting machine stops counting and it spits out this long reel of paper that will give them results. And the organizer of the, or rather the coordinator of this polling location, then reads each name and how many votes they receive. We will have a total tonight. We will have a winner tonight, but then it's certified tomorrow by the Secretary of State.
Are they anticipating any kinds of problems with the reporting mechanism given what happened in Iowa?
Good question, and I actually posed that question to one of the election officials here at this polling place. He took me through the entire procedure. People come in, they go to a table that has their name on file as a registered voter, they pick up their ballot, they mark their ballot, then they feed a ballot into an electronic counting machine, much like our ACT and SAT scores are counted. Now, this voting machine, which the official was quick to point out, is not connected to anything via Bluetooth, nothing electronic. It is hardwired into the wall. So there's a literal plug, an electric plug that goes into the wall, so no one can tamper with it. And so he said, because of that, because all the voting is done on paper ballots, and because there is no connection, electronic connection of the results to anywhere, they are confident that there won't be any mistakes tonight. There won't be any controversial calls or any confusing calls.
That was VOA correspondent Carolyn Prasuti speaking to me from New Hampshire. Authorities in Australia say heavy rain could extinguish all of the fires in New South Wales state by the end of the week. Phil Mercer reports that parts of eastern Australia have seen their heaviest downpours in more than 30 years.
Australia is a land of extremes. Some towns have gone from drought to floods in a day, as heavy rain has fallen in New South Wales and parts of Queensland. Some drought-hit farmers have had their best rainfall in a decade, while emergency authorities warned of life-threatening flash flooding. Since Friday, Australia's biggest city, Sydney, has been drenched by almost 400 millimetres of rain. That amount usually falls over 4 months. More downpours are predicted later this week. The deluge is helping a marathon firefighting effort. A huge bushfire south of Sydney that burnt for more than 70 days and destroyed 300 homes has finally been put out. Also extinguished is the so-called Gospers Mountain megablaze northwest of Sydney. On Tuesday, 26 bush and grass fires were still burning across the state of New South Wales, with 4 not yet contained. Some of these blazes have been burning for weeks and even months. David Elliott, the New South Wales Emergency Services Minister, says the heavy rain has caused chaos in some areas, but could put out all of the state's bushfires within days.
We expect that a number of local government areas will be given natural disaster declarations, which will allow for extra funding, extra support, and of course make the appropriate response from our emergency services. The silver lining, of course, is the fact that we now look like we might see the end of this six-month firefighting campaign.
In Western Australia, the clean-up continues after a tropical cyclone crossed the state's northwestern coastline at the weekend, bringing destructive winds and torrential rainfall. The Australian bushfire crisis began in September. At least 33 people have been killed and thousands of homes destroyed. More than 11 million hectares of land, an area the size of England, has been left scorched. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The founder of the South African multi-Grammy Award-winning group Ladysmith Black Mambaza, Joseph Shabalala, has died at the age of 78. Shabalala is world-renowned for his leadership of the choral group founded in 1964 that shot to world acclaim, collaborating with Paul Simon on the Graceland album and others. Shabalala retired from Ladysmith Black Mambaza in 2014, but made occasional appearances at its events. He was hospitalized several times since 2017. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and engineer, Andreas Rigas, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.